Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. In the news this week, the explosive book about the Trump White House is out, unleashing a war of words between the president and Steve Bannon. Wednesday, Presidential Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said the president is furious.
I think furious, disgusted would probably certainly fit when you make such outrageous claims and completely false claims against the president, his administration, and his family.
Anti-government protesters in Iran took to the streets chanting, "Death to the dictator." Record cold temperatures across the nation. Yesterday, a bomb cyclone hit the East Coast. Here's ABC's David Muir.
Massive and deadly winter storm, what's called a bomb cyclone, and it is living up to its name, slamming into the east. Along the east coast, several states of emergency, coastal flooding along the shore, blizzard conditions, and blinding snow.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Yoki Driesen of Vox, Kimberly Atkins of the Boston Herald, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Joining me from Washington this hour, Yoki Driesen, deputy managing editor and foreign editor for Vox. Yoki, great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Jen.
And with us from New York, Kimberly Atkins, chief Washington reporter and columnist for the Boston Herald. Kimberly, great to have you. Welcome back.
Hi, Jane.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty, as always, joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jane, Yoki, and Kimberly.
So let's begin with fresh reporting from the New York Times today, which says that President Trump gave firm instructions in March to stop Attorney General Jeff Sessions from recusing himself in the Russia investigation. When that was unsuccessful, the president erupted in front of several White House officials saying that he needed the Attorney General to protect him. Kimberly Atkins, does this go to the heart of whether the president obstructed the FBI's Russia inquiry?
Well, it's definitely something that Robert Mueller will be looking at very closely as he looks into this investigation, this and a number of other issues that comes out of this reporting, if Robert Mueller didn't already know about it already, not just this effort to dissuade Jeff Sessions from recusing himself, which as an attorney, Don McGahn, should understand the concept of conflict of interest and the administration of justice. And so doing this, which is clearly at the behest of Donald Trump to protect Donald Trump. Obviously, he is not Trump's attorney. He is an attorney for the presidency. So that in itself is questionable. And then just also the role that other attorneys are playing, sort of trying to dissuade Donald Trump to fire Comey. Clearly, this was something that people saw coming. You have, on the other hand, Jeff Sessions, his office working actively to try to find dirt on Jim Comey before he was fired. All of these are really startling revelations and really are going to be scrutinized carefully in Robert Mueller in this determination as to whether obstruction of justice took place.
So, Yoki, according to the New York Times, the president said he expected his attorney general, his top law enforcement official, to safeguard him, to protect him in the way that he believed Robert Kennedy had done for his brother when he was attorney general, or Eric Holder had done for Barack Obama. What do you make of this?
I mean, that's a profoundly frightening statement, and it's one that I think the frightening nature of it isn't always well understood, because what he's basically saying is that he expects an attorney general, the chief law enforcement officer of the United States, you know, Trump technically is that, but functionally that's what the attorney general is meant to be, to protect the president even if there is strong evidence of a crime having been committed. That is not what Robert Kennedy did. That's certainly not what Eric Holder did. But to believe that the role of the attorney general is not to oversee the administration of justice, it's not to make sure justice is impartial, it's to protect the president even when that president and his top aides are credibly accused of criminal wrongdoing, is a rather terrifying aspect of this. What we've seen with Donald Trump so far as president, if we take the step back, is one, trying to politicize the use of intelligence and simply accuse the intelligence community writ large of lying when he doesn't like what they're saying, but two, to genuinely seem to believe that he can order the Justice Department to prosecute his political enemies, which is something you see in dictatorships. You do not see in democracies a president publicly saying, prosecute Hillary Clinton, even though she's lost. Mm-hmm. Prosecute Huma Abedin. Prosecute James Comey. You simply don't see that. And so much about Trump we can, because of he says it again and again, becomes almost background noise. But there is something legitimately scary about an elected president of the United States using tactics that you see in dictatorships and autocracies, and that's what you see here.
Jack Beatty, what do you see? Are these reports frightening, as Yoki says? Are they frightening to you?
Yes. I mean, this is the pattern of an authoritarian ruler who suborns justice for his own purposes, that is, the Department of Justice. And, you know, I think this puts Sessions and his department under pressure to sort of work their passage back to Trump's favor. And we've seen signs of that. This week, there was a report that the Justice Department is starting to look at the Hillary email question again. We don't know whether there's going to be something done on Huma Abedin or not, as the president wants. A couple of weeks ago, there were leaks about the emails that FBI operatives had sent out that seemed to be anti-Trump, and that the Justice Department seemed to be going, playing into the narrative that somehow the Mueller investigation was polluted because of political bias, that they were actually helping that along. So I think what's frightening is the president says these things, and there are signs that the Justice Department is responding. Mm.
Well, beyond the Justice Department and the Attorney General, this week President Trump marshaled both his West Wing and his personal legal team against a new book that's out today, which portrays him and his administration as incompetent and erratic, just for starters. The book has already hit number one on Amazon. In a press conference yesterday, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders slammed Michael Wolff's book, Fire and Fury.
I'm not going to waste my time or the country's time going page by page talking about a book that's complete fantasy and just full of tabloid gossip.
Kimberly Atkins, what are the most contentious parts of this book?
Well, look, the thing about the book that I found interesting is while there are these little tidbits of information that certainly is great for Twitter fodder, overall, the description and the picture that is painted of the president is fairly consistent with all the reporting that we've seen since Inauguration Day and before. We have somebody who has a short attention span, isn't a big into reading policy and sort of shooting from the hip. You have somebody who really needs praise and really needs to have take credit for things. We have someone who does not like to be told no and likes to sort of be this authoritative ruler in the way that Jack was talking about. In all of that, that's the thing that struck me most, is that all of that is completely borne out. Somebody who is erratic, who is angry when he doesn't get what he wants, and who will push back against his enemies, push back against his friends if they go against his own interests. And we've seen that now this week with the really extraordinary statement that he issued against Steve Bannon after this book was released, somebody who he was, by any question, close to during the campaign and in the early parts in his White House. I mean, he installed him in his White House, put him on the top security council, panel within the White House. And suddenly now he's saying he's never heard of him. Doesn't know his name. He had very little to do with the White House in the moment. So we see how this president switches back and forth. And if you leave aside things like whether or not he knew who John Boehner was, maybe he could have been making a joke, and the issues that the White House is taking factually with this book, the overall picture that is created of this president seems really consistent with everything we've seen so far.
President Trump addressed his feud with Steve Bannon yesterday and said he no longer speaks with his former top strategist, Steve Bannon.
I don't talk to him. I don't talk to him. That's just a misnomer.
And here's Steve Bannon on Sirius XM Breitbart News Tonight on Wednesday amid this feud, saying he supports the president.
President of the United States is a great man. You know, I support him day in and day out, whether going through the country, given the Trump miracle speech, or on the show or on the website.
Well, that seems different, Yoki, than what he said in the book. I mean, remind us of this back and forth and Steve Bannon's role in particular.
So Steve Bannon, when he was trying to help shape Donald Trump's message, he was trying to say that Donald Trump would be a different kind of Republican, that he would be a nationalist, that he would be a populist, that he would not just be your run-of-the-mill Republican who wants to cut taxes, cut the welfare state, that instead he'd be somebody who would invest in infrastructure, that he's somebody who would invest in the forgotten parts of America, that he would sort of double down on helping the forgotten class of the United States. President Trump came into office, the first thing he got rid of was all of that. And what he became was not only a doctrinaire Republican, but a more extreme doctrinaire Republican than we've seen. He was more extreme by far than George W. Bush. The tax rates that he had proposed and pushed through go further than what George W. Bush wanted to do. The safety net cuts he's tried to do, including the Obamacare repeal, goes further than what George W. Bush had tried to do in terms of some of the Medicare and Medicaid reforms he had proposed. And so there already was a break in a kind of very structural way between what Steve Bannon had, one, proposed, and two, thought Donald Trump would be, to what President Trump had actually become. So when you set aside whether Steve Bannon attacked Donald Trump, attacked Donald Trump Jr., attacked Jared Kushner in the ways he did in the book, and incidentally, Steve Bannon has not denied any of the quotes attributed to him in the book, not a single one.
Right.
So even if you set that aside, the president that Steve Bannon thought he was serving and the president Donald Trump has become are entirely different. Mm.
So, Jack Beatty, the establishment Republicans seem delighted with this new rift between the president and Bannon.
Well, sure, because Bannon was, essentially on a jihad against the Republican establishment candidates. And already some of the candidates he was backing in primaries have distanced themselves from him, as well they should. Trump is the man who won. Trump is the person who speaks to the electorate, and Bannon, I think, has delusions of grandeur. But just to get back to this question that Kimberly was raising, how the Wolf book, and Wolf gets a lot of things wrong and he's got a spotty reputation, but how it tracks what we know about Trump. I mean, just this week, Susan Glasser in Politico reported what diplomats who've met him and dealt with him call, they speak of catastrophic, terrifying, incompetent, dangerous. This guy is insane, says one. These are diplomats who've dealt with Trump.
Well, we've got the Week in the News this week with Jack Beatty, Kimberly Atkins, and Yoki Driesen. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of How I Built This, with the recommendation for another podcast for you to check out, namely How I Built This. Every week, I talk to the people behind some of the most inspiring companies and brands in the world, with stories of incredible persistence, grit, and insight. You can find How I Built This on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about the week in the news, about the president's nuclear button tweet and what the Iran protests might mean for the Iran nuclear deal. You can join us, listeners. What do you expect to see in the meeting between North and South Korea upcoming? What's the message from the protesters in Iran? What do you make of the president's deep state tweets about the Justice Department? Great panel today. Yoki Driesen, Deputy Managing Editor and Foreign Editor for Vox. Kimberly Atkins, Chief Washington Reporter and Columnist for the Boston Herald. And On Point News Analyst Jack Beatty. Sticking with Fire and Fury for a moment, because we've got a lot of listeners who want to join in here on this point. Let's go to Connie first in Portage, Wisconsin. Hi, Connie. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I wanted to tell you this. I thought it was very interesting. I tried to call our capital city, Madison, Barnes & Noble, to get Fire and Fury. And he said every other call coming in is for the book. And he said they aren't even going to put it on the shelf. And he's taking our name. And there's so many people. And I thought, oh, goody, goody. I'm happy because to me, that's a sign. Wisconsin voted for Trump, but I don't think he'll ever get their vote again.
Connie, thank you. Already number one on Amazon. We hear what's happening there in Wisconsin on the bookshelves. Mark in Charlotte, North Carolina, you're on the air. Welcome, Mark.
Yeah, hey, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Yeah, I mean, just in short, listening to the discussion this morning, I mean, I counted frightful six times. And, you know, what's frightful, to be honest with you, is the lack of critical thinking. I mean, you know, number one, you got a sketchy author clearly going to make millions off of this, number one. And number two, the parsing of Bannon. I mean, Bannon's comments aren't directed at Trump. He's a Trump supporter, as he said. Now, that may change. But what he's talking about is Kushner, who probably is greasy. I mean, his dad went to jail. It's a sketchy background. And they are all Democrats. So, I mean, to me, it's pretty obvious.
All right, Mark. Thank you. Yoki, I'll let you respond to the critical thinking piece there.
So I think that that's a fair point. I mean, there have been a lot of stories, including on my site and in the Washington Post and elsewhere, that have focused in specifically on Michael Wolff as an author and on his credibility or lack thereof. So it's a fair question. Many media outlets, including ours, have devoted a lot of time to writing about him and about the book. That said, it isn't right to say that the only things in the book are attacks at Jared Kushner or attacks at other, you know, potential Democrats in the administration. The portrait that emerges of Donald Trump, qua Donald Trump, is just devastating. It's that there's a quote that Michael Wolff has in the book that 100% of the people who work for him believe that he's unsuited for the job and needs to be kind of steered away from doing lasting damage. So it is true that in the book he says Donald Trump Jr. may have been guilty of treason. It is true that he believes Jared Kushner may be a criminal. It is also true that in the writing of the book and in quotes not just from Steve Bannon but others, and no one is really denying these quotes, and again, they jive with what have been quoted before, there is genuine fear among Donald Trump's staff about Donald Trump. They worry about how they distract him, how they hold information back from him, how they give information to him in a way that he'll listen, the fact that he repeats himself in meetings, the fact that he just ignores news he doesn't like, his anger and his petulance and the hours he spends watching TV. All of that is about him, not about Jared Kushner, and all of that tracks what has been said about him since he took the office.
Mark from Charlotte, thank you for that call. Let's go to Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Carl. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. You know, I don't know why everyone is surprised about what we're getting from Donald Trump. We knew what this man was for the past 40 years. The evangelical hypocrites here in the South in particular, they put aside their moral codes and they elected a sociopath, an habitual liar, a cheater on his wife. They put aside their family values to put this man in office to get their little tax plan for their millionaires and billionaires. In short, they sold their souls for short-term gain for themselves and to hurt our country.
Carl, thank you. Kimberly, I'll let you respond to Carl, who's saying, look, Donald Trump's been an open book for 40 years. We knew what we were getting.
I think that's largely true. I mean, I think that while I agree that the president is putting forth Republican policies. So far, he has a Republican Congress with which to do that. He has delivered, by and large, exactly what he campaigned on. He's tried to be America first and delivering the travel ban and cracking down on immigration and all of the nationalistic things that he promised. He's also delivering the chaos that we saw from the campaign. I mean, the campaign was chaotic from beginning to end at the point that some news organizations essentially began covering it as entertainment. So all of those things are true. The past year that we've seen has delivered on that. And I want to make one point on Bannon, if I could.
Okay.
While it is true that Bannon, his attacks were largely directed at other people in the White House and not Donald Trump, I think the one thing that he said that probably angered the president the most was that he had only given a 33.3% chance that Donald Trump would make it through his first term and not either be impeached or removed under the 25th Amendment. And if he made it, it would only be due to Democratic incompetence. I mean, as much as Donald Trump is sensitive about even the fact that he didn't win the Electoral College, to hear something like that, as well as the attacks on his family, I mean, it's not just his staff, it's his family, is probably the reason for that ire and is probably the worst thing Steve Bannon could have said in that book.
Carl in Nashville, thank you very much for the call. Let me move to hot talk and hot tweets about North Korea this week. President Trump declared that, quote, his nuclear button was much bigger and more powerful than the one North Korea's Kim Jong-un claimed to have. This alarmed a lot of people. Former Vice President Joe Biden told NBC News that the president's tweets are irresponsible and dangerous.
Words matter. Look, the only war that's worse than one that's intended is one that's unintended. This is not a game. This is not about, can I puff my chest out bigger than your chest? It's not presidential.
I don't know, Jack Beatty. I've heard a lot of people say that this tweet in particular was alarming.
Yes, insouciance about nuclear war seems to be a level of moral obliquity that we've not seen from the president quite this badly. Gail Collins quipped, if it weren't for the exploding planet aspect of all this, it would be sort of funny. It would be. It's like that statement about my button is bigger than your button. That's a sort of Freudian delight, isn't it? We all know what that means. But this is the president of the United States. He is that insecure. He thinks at that sort of pre-adolescent level. And no one, not General Kelly, not any of the people around him, seems to be able to stop him from doing these things. And they, as Joe Biden says, could have catastrophic consequences. One of these tweets could. We've already seen how he's undermined diplomacy vis-a-vis North Korea. Let's just hope he can keep his hands off that issue at least long enough until this somewhat promising thaw between North and South Korea can proceed.
Let's go to Jim in Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Do you think the rest of the world realizes that Donald Trump's rhetoric regarding North Korea really reflects his own personal agenda and not the America as a whole?
Jim, thanks. Kimberly, is there a difference?
Clearly the president has a personal, enjoys jabbing at Kim Jong-un in a very personal way. I mean, I think in this case, the president's animosity toward the North Korean leader isn't that far off from the U.S.'s animosity toward the country and its nuclear program. So in that sense, they jibe. But the problem is the only solution to this problem is diplomatic. We don't want the exploding Earth solution. And to that extent, the tweets and outbursts from the president, the name calling, that works against all of those interests. And I found it really interesting this week that the president tweeted that the fact that North and South Korea have opened up communication channels ahead of the Olympics and are planning on meeting ahead of this, a key meeting the first in 2 years, the president's taking credit for it when it seems, at least from my standpoint, that these things are happening in spite of what President Trump is doing and not because of what he's
doing. So, Yoki, do you agree with that? Can President Trump take some credit for these upcoming talks between North and South Korea?
I think he can take credit for the fact that China seems genuinely alarmed in a way that perhaps it hasn't been in the past, that there could be – they worry tremendously about a war. I mean, they worry about refugees spilling over into their country. They worry that if North Korea uses nuclear or chemical weapons, both of which are plausible, there'd be blowback onto Chinese territory. So China is worried in a way it has not been before, which arguably is a good thing. The UN Security Council has imposed sanctions on North Korea that go further than they have in the past, which I think Donald Trump can claim some credit for. That said, the broader confusion world leaders have about Donald Trump is magnified to the nth degree by this, which is when he says one thing, but then his defense secretary, his secretary of state, his national security advisor say the exact opposite, what do you believe? Particularly if the actual policy doesn't yet reflect what Trump says. So to take just briefly the example of North Korea, if the U.S. military were seriously preparing for the kind of war that Donald Trump threatens, you would see a massive influx of troops, planes, ships. I've covered the military on and off now for 17 years. You don't go to war overnight. It takes months to prepare to go to war, and you're not seeing any of that. So right now, you're seeing tweets from Donald Trump. You're seeing his cabinet say the exact opposite, and you're not seeing his military prepare. So for the moment, you can, as a world leader, say this is very scary rhetoric, but it's not likely to happen. That said, he's the president of the United States, and the words do carry weight. And if you continue to threaten and threaten and threaten, at some point there is a substantive impact from that.
Here's UN Ambassador Nikki Haley at a press conference at the UN on Tuesday saying that the end of North Korea's nuclear program is non-negotiable.
The civilized world must remain united and vigilant against the rogue state's development of a nuclear arsenal. We will never accept a nuclear North Korea.
Kimberly Atkins, how are these words being received on Capitol Hill? I mean, you hear Nikki Haley there, you see the tweets. How are members of Congress viewing this, seeing this?
Well, look, I think everybody is viewing all of this very carefully as we move forward. Look, this isn't just an issue for Congress. This is an issue for the UN and the U.S. and its partners and its allies. And I think on the point of allies, I think that's another area where we see some trouble with the president's sort of, you know, fiat by tweet approach to foreign policy, is that a lot of times that it tends to put off, scare off some of our allies in a way that is not helpful to the U.S. government and U.S. Diplomatic efforts. So I think that is something that does raise some concern with everyone, including members of Congress.
Let's go to Iowa City. Steve is on the line. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I think Donald Trump's comments are entirely appropriate. I don't understand why people are making such a big deal out of it.
The tweets about North Korea, Steve?
Yeah, North Korea and the size of his nuclear button. He's just telling you how it is. You know, this what we have here with North Korea is a psychopathic adolescent dictator who has been getting away with just incredible amounts of heinous activity, including murdering his own family members and whatnot. And, you know, Donald Trump is basically just saying, why should the United States kowtow and mollycoddle to this, you know, this lunatic? You know, he's basically just calling his bluff, and he's basically putting the rest of the North Korean regime on notice, saying, you know, are you really going to let this pudgy little, you know, dictator destroy your entire country? Because that's what would happen, and maybe there would be some, you know, some reason in the generals, and they would perform the much overdue coup d'etat that needs to happen.
I get it, Steve. Thank you for the call, Jack Beatty. There's Steve in mm-hmm. Iowa City saying mm-hmm. Trump's mm-hmm. standing up to a dictator, doing what we should be doing.
Well, you hear that, and I think that's the president's claim that you know, the talks between the North and the South are owing to his pressure. That is the same as continuity with what the caller said. But you know, there's another party in this, and that is South Korea. And the New York Times, our friend David Sanger this week was very, I think, insightful in pointing out from South Korean sources how the North is working to split us from the South, and that the president's tweets are actually helping that. They are, I mean, our caller talks about the effect of this in North Korea. First of all, we don't know how much of this gets out in North Korea. But what about its effect in South Korea among people there who have heard Lindsey Graham paraphrasing the president? I quoted this last week. It's worth repeating, saying the president thinks, well, if people are going to die, let them die over there. Over there? That means South Koreans. These are our allies. And so these words are really, I think, being heard there and helping the North Korean strategy, which is to divide us from our ally.
Let me get in the last bit here about President Trump escalating quite an extraordinary confrontation with his own Justice Department this week, suggesting that it was, quote, part of a deep state conspiracy against him. Yoki Driesen, remind us what happened and what prompted this latest charge.
So he's been making, and it's worth just backing up very briefly on this, he's been making this charge against the Justice Department and the intelligence community for quite some time. And as the Mueller probe has kicked up, he's been making it more and more and more aggressively. And what they've been doing, and this is what Donald Trump was referring to in part in that series of tweets, is he's been trying to preemptively discredit the Mueller probe and preemptively either set the stage for firing him or set the stage for trying to have it dismissed as partisan, whatever recommendation comes out of it, by saying Bob Mueller is too close to James Comey, Bob Mueller has staffers who are Democrats, Bob Mueller on. And at the end of that road of charges against Bob Mueller is this kind of broader accusation that the Justice Department and the intelligence community are stocked with Democrats, stocked with Obama holdovers, whose sole job is to try to undermine Donald Trump. He's been making that case since before the inauguration. It is a historic and unprecedented charge to make. And whenever it turns to the issue of obstruction, whatever it turns to the issue of Russian interference, his immediate response is to say, I believe the Russians. I do not believe my own intelligence community. And it's hard to overstate just how extraordinary that is. I mean, try to imagine Barack Obama or George W. Bush ever saying publicly, I believe Vladimir Putin, I do not believe the CIA. There'd be immediate talk of this man's, he's lost his marbles, let's impeach. Donald Trump says this all the time. And again, the flip side to saying there's a deep state out to get him is saying there's a deep state out to protect Hillary Clinton. And so he's trying to take this notion of a politicized Justice Department in two directions. One, to protect himself. Two, to attack a defeated rival. Again, in a way, as Jack was saying, as I was saying a bit earlier, that you just don't see in democracies.
Kimberly Atkins, about 30 seconds before our break here. What do you make of the deep state conspiracy charge?
I mean, I think that is largely right. I mean, I think it's a lot of things. I think the president enjoys lashing out at Hillary Clinton, which is at the bottom of a lot of this. But it's extraordinary, especially given that this Justice Department that he's talking about now is being run by people he appointed. It's being run by Jeff Sessions and Rod Rosenstein and FBI Director Christopher Wray. So he's essentially accusing his own folks of running this campaign against them, which, of course, is ridiculous. And one of the downsides is that you have career folks in law enforcement who are working diligently in our Justice Department, and the president constantly denigrating them is doing nothing for morale there.
More for the Week in the News coming up. Iran, Pakistan. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
I'm Cardiff Garcia.
And we are here with a new show.
The Indicator from Planet Money.
On every show, we take some number in the news and we dive into it to find the big idea behind it.
Get it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. In other news this week, the Dow hit 25,000 for the first time ever yesterday. Here's CNBC's Carl Cantania.
There it is. Dow 25,000.
And the University of Georgia rang in the new year with a double overtime victory over Oklahoma in the Rose Bowl. Here's ESPN's Chris Fowler with the call.
Now it's Michelle's turn, running all the way. Gets to the edge. Sonny Michelle will send the Dogs home to the championship game.
And Robert Siegel has been the signature voice of NPR's All Things Considered for 30 years. He is retiring today. He spoke this week with WBUR.
If I have managed to take something a bit mystifying and demystify it and debunk some take on that subject along the way, then I feel like I've done something good that day.
We will miss him. Great panel. My guests, Yoki Driesen, Deputy Managing Editor and Foreign Editor for Vox, Kimberly Atkins, Chief Washington Reporter and Columnist for the Boston Herald, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. To Iran now, the U.S. has requested a U.N. Security Council meeting on Friday, today, to discuss the situation in Iran. What started as a couple of scattered protests over the cost of food has quickly erupted into a countrywide movement, Iranians taking to the streets in nearly every province. Yoki Driesen, what do you see in these demonstrations?
So what's fascinating about these is, one, where they're taking place, and sort of, two, who's making up the protesters. The last time there were protests that were on the scale, and frankly were actually bigger than the current protests, was in 2009. This was something where Barack Obama faced a difficult choice of whether to say anything about them for fear of that being used by the regime to say these protests are illegitimate or to keep quiet. He largely kept quiet and was criticized ever since. But those protests in 2009 were mainly in Tehran, the capital. They were mainly carried out by the well-educated, in some cases English-speaking, sort of urban elite. In some cases, what we would think of as Blue America, the equivalent of Iran, Blue Iran. The current protests are taking place all over the country, including in many rural areas. So again, I'm not trying to make the exact comparison, but if we're thinking the blue-red divide, this would be Red America or Red Iran. And so you're seeing a much bigger slice of the Iranian country, the Iranian demographic makeup, take part in these protests. The other thing that's really important to notice is that these protests are going after literally every part of the modern Iranian state. So they are going after the elected president, President Rouhani, who by Iranian standards is considered a moderate. They're also going after the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, whose power in the country is paramount. They're going after him by name. They're going after the Quds Force, which is its major paramilitary operation. They're going after the Iranian military. They're going after other prominent Iranian generals, again, by name. And you have not seen that before. You have not seen protests that are this broad in terms of what parts of the country take place, but also protests that are willing to criticize the supreme leader of the country by name, to criticize the military, which is hugely powerful, the intelligence services, which are hugely powerful. That's what's new. You have not seen that before on this scale.
Hmm. Here's some sound of pro-government demonstrations from earlier this week as reported by the Associated Press.
My God, America!
Those counter demonstrations. And then during a White House press briefing on Tuesday, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders described what President Trump would like to see happen now in Iran.
The ultimate end game would be that the citizens and the people of Iran are actually given basic human rights, and he'd certainly like to see them stop being a state sponsor of terror. I think that's something the whole world would like to see.
Mike Pence, Vice President Mike Pence, came out with a Washington Post editorial this week saying that the U.S. will take Iran seriously this time. Yoki, what do you think he meant by that?
That's kind of the big question, because the major policy question that hangs over these kind of protests, whether they're in Iran, whether during the Arab Spring they were in Egypt, is do you offer support to the protesters, whether it's rhetorical support, whether it's financial support, whether, as has been suggested, you remove the travel ban on Iran so that Iranians can leave and see the West and then go back. If you do that, that makes it easier for the government to dismiss the protesters, as is already happening in Iran, basically as sort of foreign puppets. It's easier for them to say, see, these protesters aren't legitimate Iranians. They're being paid by America or being paid by Israel. And so that's the argument against doing anything, and that's in some ways why Barack Obama didn't. Then, of course, there's the argument in favor, which is these are people who ostensibly share our values, who ostensibly are either pro-democratic or at a very bare minimum anti the current government of Iran, which we, the U.S., see as adversarial, and therefore we should get involved. What Mike Pence is hinting is that they will do something more concrete than the Obama White House did, but he's not being clear as to what that is. It's also very important to note what the president and his staff have not said, which is regime change. They have not used the phrase, even though many of their base, many of their supporters in Congress, including Senator Tom Cotton, openly say the goal of the United States should be to overthrow the current government of Iran and replace it. Donald Trump is being very careful to go up to that line, but then not say our goal is to overthrow the current government.
Let's get Tripp in here from Nashville on this point. Tripp, glad you called. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was struck by President Trump's tweet in support of the protesters, because kind of connecting some of the dots of some of the previous stories about his tweets and how they seem to be a projection, if not just evidence of Freudian slip-ups or things like that. I was just struck that he would support protesters while completely ignoring the people on the streets in America that are trying to get, you know, a minimum wage increase or, you know, any kind of help with mental health care or you know, healthcare in general.
Mm. Tripp, thanks so much for the call. Kimberly, do you see Tripp's point? Do you see similarities
yeah.
there?
No? Yeah, I mean, it's not the first time that someone has said that. I mean, not just, you know, in terms of the living wage of folks in the United States, but also people who protest against Donald Trump in the way he really tends to slap them down and sort of really dismiss them in a way, while he is, of course, supporting, full-throatedly supporting the folks who are protesting in Iran. It just sort of points again to his own view of the world and his own interests. He sees Iran very much as an adversary, as a state sponsor of terror. He has repeatedly criticized the Iran nuclear deal as a bad deal that was negotiated by the Obama administration and has tried in every way except for completely pulling out of it, trying to strike that down. And this is yet again, on another point, another area where it is causing a rift with our allies. I mean, an initial statement that was supposed to be released between the U.S. and Germany and France was never done because the European allies do not want to align themselves with this full-throated backing of people, of the protesters, in a way, for a lot of reasons, including the one pointed out that the more President Trump backs the protesters, the more that can fuel the Iranian Iranian point that these protests are really made of foreign influences and are not a part of an actual genuine uprising.
Mm. Well, let's turn from Iran to Pakistan now for a moment, because on Tuesday, following President Trump's criticism of Pakistan, UN Ambassador Nikki Haley announced that the U.S. will now withhold $255 million in aid.
Pakistan has played a double game for years. They work with us at times, and they also harbor the terrorists that attack our troops in Afghanistan. That game is not acceptable to this administration. We expect far more cooperation from Pakistan in the fight against terrorism.
Yoki, this idea that Pakistan has been playing, quote, a double game for years. I mean, the administration has been talking about this for many months. Why is it in the news now again?
So it's an interesting question. We actually have a piece going up on Vox.com on Friday that kind of looks at that. But right now, President Trump, despite having during the campaign and even in the early months of his presidency, having said we shouldn't be in Afghanistan, we need to pull out of Afghanistan, he is sending more troops into Afghanistan. And to do that, you need to have reliable supply routes through Pakistan, and you need to have some confidence that Pakistan won't have safe havens as they've had in the past for terrorists to then cross the basically non-existent border between the countries to attack U.S. troops. What's interesting is that in this particular set of remarks, they appear to come out of nowhere, but they are specifically tied to the ongoing influx of new U.S. troops into Afghanistan. Donald Trump is saying the exact same thing and doing the exact same thing as Barack Obama did and as George W. Bush did before him, which is to say, wait a minute, we're giving Pakistan billions of dollars a year in aid, we're reimbursing them for money they're spending on counterterrorism missions, but all the while we know for a fact that they have safe havens along their border that are being used for terror attacks inside of Afghanistan. We know, as with the case of Osama bin Laden, that there are terrorists of all level of rank and prominence being sheltered inside Pakistan. Why are we giving them this money if they're allowing these things to take place? So this appears to come out of nowhere, even though it really kind of doesn't. And it may appear as a Donald Trump is just going off, losing his temper again, or sort of going off the rocker again. But what he is saying and how he is saying it and what he's doing are all things that his predecessors have said and done.
In fact, I need to add here that the Trump administration said it would suspend nearly all security aid, not just the $255 million, all security aid to Pakistan, which could affect as much as $1.3 billion in annual aid there. So, Yoki, thank you for that perspective. I want to go back to U.S. soil now because the Senate gained two new Democratic senators this week, Doug Jones of Alabama, who defeated Roy Moore in a contentious race, and Tina Smith, who was appointed to fill Al Franken's seat after he resigned due to sexual misconduct allegations. Here's their swearing-in ceremony with Vice President Mike Pence.
That you take this obligation freely, without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that you will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which you are about to enter. So help you God.
I do.
Congratulations, Senator.
Jack Beatty, what does it mean now for the GOP with these two new Democrats in the Senate? Obviously, it narrows the already slender majority in the Senate.
Yes. And, you know, I'm struck by this. This is a victory for the Me Too movement. I mean,
in what way?
Well, the issue of treatment of women was at the center of Doug Jones's victory.
Yeah.
And of Al Franken's resignation. This is a social movement that has helped to propel, I think, both these candidates there. And I think that's probably not the last time we're going to see that. But you know, there was another move in the Senate this week: retirement announcement from Orrin Hatch, and possibility that Mitt Romney will run for the office to succeed him. You know, for people who hope for a kind of rehabilitated post-Trump Republican Party, this is something to be, you know, to look forward to. Mitt Romney has staked out a strong position against Trump's really degradation of the presidency. When he ran for the president, he said he's playing the American public for suckers. He called him a fraud and a phony. And consistently, he has stood up and really, I think, stood out among Republicans in denouncing the excesses of Trumpism, the poisonous ethnic bigotry and so on. And if he could carry that into the Senate, that would be a strong moment, a chance to rally people in the Republican Party against this Trump populism.
Let's go to Honolulu, Hawaii. Julian is calling from there. Hi, Julian. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Hi. Great panel today. I just wanted to say I'm concerned that the press has been reading the numbers wrong and kind of missing the story. And for the Democrats, I'm concerned that there might be this kind of delusional overconfidence that we saw with Hillary Clinton right ahead of the 2016 election, where, you know, the commentators last week on this program were citing the fact that, you know, Trump's approval ratings are way down at 35%. Well, you know, he got elected with 26% of eligible voters. So if he's at 35% approval ratings, he's doing great, and he's going to keep playing to his base. And, you know, I know this is the congressional races. So in the House, you've got gerrymandering, which is going to be a major factor, and all of the Democratic seats that are vulnerable in the Senate. And if I could just make one last point about all this, it's that, you know, Hillary Clinton got 26% of the vote. Trump got 26% of the vote. 48% of eligible voters either didn't vote or, you know, voted for Jill Stein or cast some symbolic vote or Gary Johnson.
Yep, I got it, Julian. Thank you. Kimberly Atkins, do you sense an overconfidence for Democrats in 2018, as we just heard from Honolulu?
I mean, I think it's a valid point that's worth asking. Look, looking at 2018, although we see polls that show growing favoritism for Democratic control of the Congress, the map is still very, very much in favor of Republicans. There are some potentially bright spots, a great deal, especially on the House side, of the Republican seats, where there are a lot more Republican seats that Democrats would have to flip than the other way around, which is what I mean by the map. But a lot of those districts are places where Hillary Clinton did win in 2016. So Democrats feel confident that they can at least compete in these places. But the map still heavily favors Republicans. So Democrats have to not just run against Donald Trump, which clearly didn't work in 2016 for Hillary Clinton, but they have to really spell out how the policies of the Republican Congress and the Republican White House are not what these voters want and how they have a different plan to move ahead. If they can do that, I think there are opportunities here, but that, yes, this is still very much a toss-up for 2018. And on 2020, yes, Hillary Clinton was an unpopular candidate running against another unpopular candidate. So that was a very specific thing. The Democrat... It depends on who the Democrats put forward in an effort to challenge President Trump to see how the numbers change given his unpopularity.
You get the last word, Yoki, in our last 15 seconds. A toss-up in 2018? How do you see it?
I think odds are Democrats take the House, but I totally agree with the caller and people who have emailed and probably made a similar point. Given what happened in election night for the presidency, I think Democrats should not take anything for granted until their candidates are inaugurated.
Well, thank you so much. Our first roundtable of the new year. A great panel today. Yoki Driesen, Deputy Managing Editor and Foreign Editor for Vox. Always a pleasure to have you, Yoki. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jim.
Kimberly Atkins, Chief Washington Reporter and Columnist for the Boston Herald. Thank you so much, Kimberly.
My pleasure.
And Jack Beatty, thank you as always, Jack.
Thank you, Jane. Happy New Year.
To you. And thank you, listeners. We appreciate your input. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.